Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Hello, everyone. This is Steve Clark, and thanks so much for tuning into the show. Today I have with me someone who is not only a five-time Pac-12 Coach of the Year, a two-time ITA National Coach of the Year, but he seems to figure out how to create a dynasty by winning five NCAA championships in the last 7 years, four of them in a four-peat. It just so happens his name is Pete. So welcome, Peter Smith, head coach of USC, the commander of Trojan Tennis. How you doing, Peter?
Doing great, Steve. Thanks for having me on the show. Real pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so I got a question. I hear a lot of cutting in and out. Did you hear that, or is that just me?
I don't hear that.
Okay, all right, good. Well, let me go through a little bit of background before getting into some nuts and bolts of our time together. I've known Peter for some 25-plus years and have seen him go from coaching at LVSU, Long Beach State, his alma mater, to head coach at Fresno State and then Pepperdine, and now at USC where he has done for sure what will become Hall of Fame work. And those of you listening to me regularly know that the goal of this show is to encourage and so we can promote tennis, sportsmanship, and develop greater players. Well, I think Peter, for sure, will have a lot to say that will help inspire and instruct all of us listening. And I'd like to say to everyone that yourself has always had the mind better.
Steve,
yes,
for some reason I lost you there.
Steve, I can barely hear you.
Barely hear me right there?
No, I got you now.
Can you barely hear me?
I got you.
You got me now.
Yeah,
okay. So
yeah, I got you now, but it is cutting in and out. I called you on my office line just to make sure.
Okay, yeah, it's cutting in and out, so I'm not sure what's going on there. Well,
can
you hear me now?
I can hear you now, but it cuts in and out a little bit.
Okay. Well, let me know if I'll keep going there. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you fine now.
Okay. The last thing I was mentioning is that, Peter is definitely a learner himself, and that's one of the great characteristics of a champion. And I'd like to give an example of this, and if Peter, if you can kind of bear with me for a sec, I want to give an example, and I know you want to get on and talk about other things, but I think this is instructive for everybody. I remember, I think he was coaching at Fresno State, and he asked about some fundraising ideas, and I remember we talked about that. That was many, many years ago. Well, now he's the captain of a Titanic, one of the greatest programs in the country, and attracting enormous fundraising ability, And I remember one of the things we had talked about at the NCAAs, you mentioned there was some new exciting stuff happening over at your tennis facility. Can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, well, I think first off is everybody loves a winner, and I think USC especially loves a winner. And you know, we had a wonderful facility, but it was built in 1970. We've had a lot of changes here at USC, a lot of upgrades. Probably they've spent upwards of almost $150 million on the different facilities and buildings just within the athletic department in the last 3 years. So, I felt like comparing our facility to theirs, it was a 1970s facility. So we were really fortunate that Gary Buntman stepped forward with a naming gift for the facility, a big gift, which really it jump-started our fundraising. And we had a couple other foundations and some really exceptional people, Michael Utengzu, the Fritz Burns Foundation, the Goldman Foundation, really some wonderful, wonderful people step up with some really significant gifts. And we were really able to raise close to $12 million in under a year. And so we not only, got the facility going, but we were able to fully pay for it in a year of fundraising. So we had some exceptional help here from USC. But really it was just, people I think really wanted to support our program. And, Trojans really support their alma mater.
Yeah, I know. I know I had Dick Bornstedt as my assistant for some time at UC Irvine. I remember once a Trojan, always a Trojan. So I can see that.
Well, Dick,
and that actually,
Dick is,
yeah,
he's as noble a Trojan as there is out there. That is for sure.
He's an amazing character in terms of integrity and just being a great man. So you're absolutely right. That actually segues into another question I got. You're the third coach of a storied program, following, really good friend Dick Leach and before him, the great George Toley, unless I'm missing something, if there's another coach in that. But you have some big shoes to fill, and you have filled them big time. Often programs like this, I call them the big four. There's USC, Stanford, UCLA, and Georgia. Stanford, for example, had Dick Gould and John Whitlinger, and now Paul Goldstein. They're all alum. UCLA had Glenn Bassett and now Billy Martin. And then Georgia had McGill and now Diaz. You're not a Trojan by birth. So, how did this come about? I think I know the story, but maybe you could share that with our listeners, kind of how that came about.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was really interesting. I was at Pepperdine and doing well at Pepperdine. The year Coach Leach decided to retire, we were having a good year. We had gotten to the quarterfinals of the NCAAs that year. And I kind of went through my head, okay, Coach Leach retired. Am I interested in this job? And I just kind of set it aside and didn't really deal with it too much. And at the NCAAs, Dick went out, in a perfect way. Everyone should go out like that, winning the NCAA championship. And I was watching the NCAA championship match, and Daryl Gross, the associate athletic director, came up to me and said, "Are you interested in the job?" And I said, "I'm interested in being interested." I think everyone would say they would look at it, but I wasn't so sure. And lo and behold, I'm still at the NCAAs. As you know, we stay there for 2 weeks sometimes. And he called me back 3 days later and said, "I'm officially offering you the job." And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Wow. Wow.
I haven't even, talked this over with my wife. I haven't been back home. My wife had some talking to do. We were living in Malibu, and we drove to the school, and she definitely needed to be recruited a little bit. My assistant at the time, Todd Dobler, certainly helped me with that. But we walked the campus, And I had actually never walked through the campus. And, you know, about we had just passed a track or next to the PE building, and my assistant looked at me and said, "You're an idiot if you don't take this job." And I said, "Trust me." I said, "Trust me, I'm not an idiot." And, you know, it's just such a – what a lot of people, you know, a lot of people talk about this school being in a bad area. I don't really think that's true, and I don't mind when anybody says that, because anybody who's been to the campus, it's such a beautiful campus. I had no idea how beautiful it was. And you're right, I was not a Trojan, and that was kind of interesting. You know, that they hired a non-Trojan, so to speak. And, you know, I had some obstacles to overcome. One of the funny stories is we had a professor call. He had been a business professor for a long time. He called me up and he said, you know, "I'd like to have a dinner honoring Coach Leach." And I said, "Yeah, okay." And he said, "You know, I just want to congratulate you on your championships." And I said, "Okay, great." And he said, "You know, you're a Trojan." And I said, "Oh, really?" And he said, "You know, I didn't know about you when they hired you because you weren't a Trojan." And I said, "Oh, really? I'm just listening." And he said, I said, "So now I'm a Trojan?" And he said, "Yes, you're a Trojan." And I said, "So I wasn't a Trojan before I won the first championship?" He said, "No." And I said, "Was I a Trojan after the first?" He said, "No." I said, "After the second?" "No." And I said, "Third." He said, "The third did it. You're a Trojan now." And I was like, wow, this is a tough club to join.
Tough crowd.
You know, at a lot of places, you win one, and they're celebrating you for a long time. And, you know, I think that's the power of USC, that there's been so much success here, not only in men's tennis, but in all the programs, that the expectation is very, very high. And so, you know, filling the shoes of Coach Leach were big, but just, you know, being a member of the coaching fraternity at USC and being successful here, there's been a lot of success in a lot of sports. And that's, I think, really helped us to be as successful as we were, because when we were, you know, one or two, they didn't have a parade for us, that's for sure. You know, we celebrated, and, you know, but the expectation here is, okay, you did great, go do it again. So I think
right.
That helps us.
Well, thanks for sharing that. Do you hear me there?
Yes.
Okay, good. So one of the things in bios, a lot of times when we read through things, you know, we get a lot of as the adult, you know, the coaching, what they did collegiately, et cetera, but very few times it's the juniors. And for the encouragement and inspiration of our juniors, Peter, what was your junior experience like? Can you share that with us?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's not a lot written about my junior career because there wasn't a lot there. You know, I was
right there is encouraging, because kids know,
yeah,
hey, I don't have to be number one in the world to do great things.
Well, I was this kid, you know, probably like a lot of kids, just stumbling through life, not really knowing which way's up. You know, when I was a young kid, I grew up in Connecticut until the age of 14, and then my dad retired and we moved to North County, San Diego, La Costa. So in some ways, I had the best childhood I could ever dream of. If anybody can recreate a perfect childhood, it was probably me. In Connecticut, I had tons of freedom, did really whatever I wanted to do. I played ice hockey all winter, you know, would literally ride our bikes to ponds in the middle of the woods and have pickup hockey games. It was really just amazing. I was the youngest of five kids, had, you know, three great older brothers, and, you know, it was really just a charmed life. I was, you know, 6 years younger than the oldest brother, so I was, you know, looked at a little differently in my family, but just being so much younger. But yeah, I played tennis all summer, hockey all winter, but I played every sport. I was on the diving team, I played baseball. I played football. I played basketball unsuccessfully, but I tried. But you name it, I was playing it. And I think that was just a very special childhood. And then when I was 14, my mom basically told my dad, we're moving to California with or without you. She was done with the winters in Connecticut. And we went right. vacationing in Coronado. And my dad and I were playing tennis every day. And my mom drove up to La Costa and bought a house without even him looking at it. So she was definitely done with Connecticut. So we moved to La Costa. And we were just so fortunate. You know, my mom saw Pancho Segura was the pro at La Costa. And really, you know, that's all she knew. So she knew I liked tennis. So she wanted me to kind of be close to that club. We joined La Costa. And, you know, just this amazing experience growing up around Lorne Kuehl and Bobby Riggs and Pancho Segura and people like Guy Fritz and just, you know, every day people were betting big money. I mean, I distinctly remember playing for, you know, $3,000 a set. I mean, you picture that in 1978. It's a lot of money. And so I'm not a bettor or a gambler still to this day, but we were always betting something every day. I wasn't usually betting my own money. But to grow up around that, the cast of characters, and they all were so wonderful to me, was really, really special. And, you know, I remember one year we planned a Hawaii vacation, and it just so happened to be during sectionals, and I went to my coach, and I said, what do I do? And he said, I can promise you in 20 years you'll never remember how you do in sectionals, but you'll never forget Hawaii. Go to Hawaii. So I didn't play sectionals, and we went to Hawaii. So, you know, I don't think we were the typical junior family. And so I was just kind of cruising. And, you know, I was ranked like 20 in Southern Cal, which was pretty good. You know, there were some pretty good players playing. Kelly Jones, John Letts played in the finals of Kalamazoo that year, 7-5 in the fifth. Rick Leach was in there. Derek Restaño, Jeff Tarango. I mean, a lot of future great pros. I'm probably forgetting a few, but there were a lot of great players. And, you know, so I was a kid that was – I was lucky to be in the second weekend of a designated tournament. I was pretty average, you know, but that's comparing to all these kids. I did good in high school and things like that. I played high school tennis. But overall, you know, wouldn't change anything that I did. But I had a lot to learn going to college.
Right. Well, thanks for sharing that. Let's switch on over to college tennis. I think you'd agree with me that being a student athlete is very demanding and shaping. It shapes a person in most institutions. You know, I think there's some that are be pretty obvious in saying that some are more demanding academically. But can you share with us about your philosophy of coaching collegiately with a student athlete in mind?
Well, I mean, first off, this should be an absolute wonderful experience. I take pity on some kids that go to school and don't have a great experience, because this should be the time of their lives, and I try and always remember that. You know, it's still hard. I got to be a coach, but you know, I think we should be having a lot of fun every day, and I think it's okay to work very hard and have fun while doing it. You know, we play a ton of ultimate frisbee. We do some different things, you know, but, you know, having a great experience playing college tennis is really important to me, to these kids. You know, they should just be having the time of their lives, obviously, within, you know, the boundaries that we've set forth. But, yeah, it's challenging. I think it's gotten a lot more challenging for these kids in the last 5 or 6 years. I think social media has made those kids' lives very, very complicated. I think there's a ton going on in their lives, and, you know, it's hard for them to really focus on two things and do things really well, because they're being hit by a lot of different other things through all of the different various forms of social media.
Good. Good. Quick question. I've had this with some guys. You know, tennis players, you know, you and I grew up playing a bunch of different sports. And some of these guys, you know, they've only played, you know, tennis. I've had some players are all thumbs when it comes to basketball or ultimate frisbee. So I'm just curious. I mean, I grew up playing ultimate frisbee in college myself. So for 30-something years, I've played it. And I took my team out here last year out on Roos Field, which is this, you know, red turf, and it was a blast. But I think it was the first time any of these guys had ever played. You know, you have to kind of teach them the game and even how to play defense because it's a whole different deal getting between. Anyway, so do you ever have to, like, actually coach your guys in ultimate so they actually know how to play the game?
Well, that's part of the recruiting process. You got to make sure you can throw a frisbee. I mean,
yeah,
you know, we make sure there's a frisbee close by and test their skills. But, you know, it's like – no, I mean, to me, it's fun. It teaches them teamwork.
Right.
It teaches them competitiveness. I mean, and you're right. A lot of these kids don't play a lot of other sports. And, you know, I think, you know, we've got four incredible freshmen this year. And I think most of the freshmen that come in and see me and my upperclassmen on a ultimate frisbee field, they just think we've completely lost it. You know, it's like, you know, everything kind of great and bad can happen on an ultimate football game because, you know, there's a lot of, you know, you're touching other guys, you're, you know, and guys just aren't used to it. I mean, you know, you're playing defense and, but I think it's a great scenario for the guys to have to work through. And, you know, I don't care what anybody says, you play even a half an hour or an hour of ultimate frisbee, that's as good a workout as there is. And, you know, it is about defense.
Well, if you're
defense.
Doing it right, you're gassed. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they got to play man-to-man defense. And we just have a ball playing it. And fortunately, you know, I'm not the top pick anymore, but I'm certainly in the top three still. So, but we have a blast doing it. And I think there's a certain competitive level that we bring to the field that we try and cross over to the tennis court because tennis is so personal and, you know, it's just kind of a weird sport in a lot of ways. And I think it can get a lot of guys' heads and ultimate frisbee, you know, you fall to the ground, you get up, you know, you kind of forget about pressure and things like that because you're worried about other things. But in tennis,
right.
you can be inside your head a little bit. So that's just fun. I mean, there's not one kid on my team that doesn't run to the ultimate frisbee field. We have an absolute ball playing it.
That's good. That's good. Well, related, you mentioned about the pressure, and we were talking before the show. I just want to maybe speak to this issue. Is you have several guys, USC, you know, as a lot of colleges do, but USC has a few guys on the tour right now, and, you know, U.S. was watching Stevie Johnson, and but I got a question for you. Do you feel that, you know, because there's a lot of dialogue back and forth on this, but is college tennis a great training ground for the pro tour? You know, from my perspective, I'm seeing a lot of guys doing, you know, well, and they're getting out there and, you know, graduating in 4 years like Stevie did, and you get out there and you're playing. Is it a viable, you know, you played on the tour, so is it a viable training ground for the pro tour?
But I'd turn it around and I'd ask this question, you know, who in the last 10 years has made it in tennis not going to college? I mean, nobody. I mean, I guess Donald Young, you could say, but I mean, Kudla's.
Oh, from the U.S.
From the U.S., yeah. I mean,
right.
I think, first of all, it's a really big mistake for us to compare our kids to European kids. You've coached them, I've coached them. You know, the kids that come here, I always say, are 1 to 2 years more mature than ours. And I think with, you know, the homeschooling that's going on right now, our kids are not very worldly. They're not very mature. And, you know, we have a great group right now, and I think we're going to have some incredible pros out of this 97-98 group. That's the year they were born. You know, Tommy Paul qualified. Donaldson's doing great. TFO's doing great. Kozlov's doing great. Taylor Fritz is poised to have greatness. Riley Opelka. All those kids are really, they're going to do good. So that argument's about to go away. But, you know, if you turn it around, you know, Jack Sock went to high school. Didn't go to college, went to high school. Stevie and John Isner both went to 4 years of college. And Sam Querrey went to high school. None of those kids, you know, were not, you know, they were not homeschooled. They didn't play ITFs. So I do think in some ways we're missing the boat that, you know, you need to turn out a whole human being to the mm-hmm. Pro Tour. I mean, the Pro Tour is tough. And, you know, I've been very close to Robert Farah and Steve Johnson and others that have gone through it, you know, going back to people like Prakash Armitage and Robert Kendrick, who I coached and knew so well. You know, those, it'll eat you up. And if you're not ready for it, I don't care how good you are, it's going to be very tough on you. And so I don't think you need to go to 4 years of college, but I think 2 years of college is great. You know, and it's kind of like a halfway house. You're moving away from home. You're learning how to live on your own. And people don't get it that, well, they're like, oh, I'm 18, I'm great. Well, I can go live on my own and just play tennis all day, and that will prepare me for it. But, you know, there's two sides of it. You know, it's not about just being a good tennis player. And I know when kids fail at USC, they don't fail in tennis. They kind of fail outside the courts by making the wrong mistakes, wrong decisions at 10 at night or later. And so I just think I'm not saying every kid has a different story and a different path, but I think college tennis is definitely a viable option to make kids really whole and complete, and then to turn them loose to the world.
Right. No, that's some good things. I wholeheartedly agree with you. I've had some parents ask me about, you know, should they play high school tennis? I said, look, I don't care if they're, you know, number one in their state. If they play high school tennis, you know, if they're going to beat everybody soundly, at least maybe they can work on their serve and volley or work on a, you know, approach and get in off a return. I mean, there's always something you can work on, but it's the team dynamic, and it's being part of that with, I think that's valuable.
Never underestimate the power of high school tennis. There is, you know, look, you know, in Southern Cal, you can be a great player and go through a whole year and not win a tournament. But to be BMOC, big man on campus, and walk around your school being the best at something in your school and get that kind of attention, that is really good for kids' self-confidence and their ego. And that's hard to recreate outside of that. And I think that's great. I think that's great for kids to have that responsibility and play. You know, all my kids have played high school tennis, and, you know, my son just led his team to CIF championship, and, you know, to see him that happy was amazing.
Yeah, that's neat. Related to that, Peter, you had mentioned a couple times, you know, you and I have both, you know, coached foreign players, and we have foreign players. You know, you get this a lot, some people, and there's, you know, we have some very close friends between us that are, you know, that would have, you know, strong opinions on both sides of the fence here. So I just want your opinion on this. I'm referring to, you know, sometimes there's so many foreign players in college tennis, you know, even I can't put a line in the sand like when it increased a lot, but, you know, it used to be maybe 25%. Now it's like 75% of the top 100 or maybe 50% are foreign. And I've just seen it change dramatically over the years. And I remember back at the ITA, we took a straw vote, you know, about restricting scholarships, et cetera. But it seems that some teams are all foreign, and even the coaches, and they sustain pipelines from countries, et cetera. But I think schools like USC, UCLA, Stanford, Georgia have been able to have success and not have to rely on that because of, you know, the notoriety and the success in the past. You have a little more bigger piece of the pie. But in general, I'd just like to get your thoughts on that, where you think it's going, and maybe shed some wisdom on both sides. So, you know, for the people who are a little, maybe they might get a different point of view. Oh, I haven't thought of that aspect of it. Maybe you could share a little bit what you think.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably talk about this for 2 hours, but, you know, I think in a perfect world, if I have 12 kids on my team, if I had three of them as international students, that would be great. I can't really put my finger on it, but, you know, for the American kids, I think they take a lot of this for granted. You know, a foreign kid comes over here and they absolutely cannot believe that, you know, heck, a UC Irvine, LMU exists and has all this, you know, incredible resources for them. But like SC UCLA, I mean, they look at these things like their Olympic training centers, you know, kind of in a lot of ways they have. And so having that, you know, when you coach a team, your team actually has a huge influence on the freshmen. You know, I'm with them 3-4 hours a day, and certainly I shape my team, but, you know, having that input from some very mature kids, whether they're from Holland or Germany or South America or Estonia, these kids always take school a little bit more serious. They've come so far, and to have that maturity with them at night and in the library, you know, I think in today's world, and, you know, I have 3 boys and watch them do this sometimes, is, you know, what can I get away with? What can I do the least amount to get by? And a lot of the foreigners don't have that. I would say, you know, 90% of those are like 3.5 or above students. I mean, they come here and they don't mess around with their studies. And to have that kind of influence on my impressionable young Americans is a great thing. I'm a big fan of American tennis. Again, I have 3 teenage boys that play USTA tennis, so I'm very aware of all that. But, you know, I think having that component of having that influence on your team is invaluable. I'm a big fan of it. I mean, men's tennis has done more to kind of keep the balance towards Americans more than any sport in the NCAA. We've passed rule after rule after rule. And the one rule we didn't pass, which I think we should pass, is making half of your scholarships, you know, you can't have more than half of your kids as international on scholarship. I think that would be a great rule, but we've been worried that that's unconstitutional and we're setting ourselves up for a lawsuit, but I say we go for it. But
I think probably at the same meeting I was, because that's what we took a straw vote on. So, the beaters see where that goes. I want to back up a smidge on all this discussion right now. If we have a young player listening, what would you say to an up-and-coming player or maybe their parents that wants to play college and pro? Just maybe maybe your 3 top words of advice to keep in mind when they're kind of going through that stage in life and they're thinking about college and, boy, they'd sure like to play pro. What would be your advice to them?
Well, first of all, it's a very long marathon, and I don't think, you know, it's really unfortunate. I just finished, was part of finishing my middle son's junior career this year at Kalamazoo, Riley, who had a great Kalamazoo and, you know, came in 3rd in doubles and, you know, won some matches in singles, and he really did good. But, you know, I was walking away with a lot of parents that I've sat at a lot of tournaments. And we're all a little melancholy walking away, but, you know, I asked them all the same question, would you do this all over again? And they all chuckled. And a lot of them said, I don't know. I mean, it's a very long journey for the kids and for the parents. And, you know, I think it's very easy to get incredibly competitive when the kids are 10 and have them be successful, but usually who's winning when it matters. You know, I wasn't a great junior, so I never thought any result in juniors was important at all. But the kids who are winning when they're 18, 19, 20, 21 are the most athletic. And I think having them stop and play other sports is tough. I think building that great athlete until they're maybe 13 or 14 is important. And, you know, if I had to do it all over again, I would have had my kids play other sports much longer. I mean, they all got competitive and wanted to really focus on tennis around 10, I made sure all my kids played a number of sports. Not as many as I did, but I wanted them playing football. I wanted them playing basketball. I wanted them playing baseball, doing all those things. And I wanted them to make the decision on their own. I think they all wanted to be a part of my life, so they all chose tennis. but you know, that's what I would say is, you know, really zero in on that when they get older. And, you know, I know Stevie, such a good athlete. I mean, he can play any sport, and he played a lot of sports until he was really later, you know, till high school. And I think David Epstein wrote a great book, The Athletic Gene. I think that's the name of it. And he said all the great pros in all the sports are coming from small towns where they're dabbling in a lot of different sports and becoming the best athlete they can possibly become. And it's just a really long journey. And I think everybody's goal should be to play college tennis and have this wonderful experience. And, you know, hopefully that comes true for a lot of them, because I know a lot of kids that play college and they just have the best experience, and that's how it should be.
Well, let me chime in, because, you know, I grew up in a small town, and you know, I played all the sports, kind of like yourself. And then it wasn't until later in life, you know, I tell my son, man, I didn't even pick up a racket until I was 13. And then, you know, and it's how do you combat that? So I'm asking from a parent's perspective. Let's say there's a parent out there saying, well, man, but we hear all the time you got to start younger and younger and focus on this. And, you know, what I'm, you know, for you from experience and for me from experience, we know that, look, you can do all these other sports and it develops your body, your mindset, your competitiveness and all this. But we're also seeing the flip side, which you even mentioned about, you know, kids, that's all they do is focus on that. And it's a long journey, et cetera. So what would you, so let's say a parent, you're saying it's hard to backtrack, you know, a parent is kind of got them all already into the system and that's all they're doing. How might they kind of just, you know, dock the boat for a little bit and maybe take some thought on this and get the, you know, you're not going to all of a sudden go, okay, we got to get our kid involved in soccer for a year. But what might somebody who's already kind of committed themselves to this one track and, but really their kid isn't physically developed yet, you know, what might they do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you know, my nephew Keegan had a great year this year, and he played basketball for his high school team last year. Completely, I mean, didn't play much tennis at all for 4 or 5 months. Played high school tennis, and I think it really taught him a lot of things. Got him in great shape, and he was ready to go. And that was as a sophomore, you know, so, you know, I don't think it's ever too late. I mean, I think if you study history, Roddick, I think, played some high school basketball. I think Marty Fish was a great golfer, did some other things. Stevie was great in a lot of sports. I know Sam played some other sports. Isner was a great basketball player. I mean, you know, it's a crock that you're, it's just wrong to think you need to focus at 10. You know, first of all, you need to have a blast and you need to enjoy it and you need to fall in love with it. And, you know, when we got away, you know, we kind of got rid of the 12 and under rankings 20 years ago, everyone said, oh, that was the worst thing in the world. But at that time, they were trying to like prevent a lot of these kids focusing on tennis. And I think all of that, I'm not saying get rid of that, but I'm just saying, you know, it's crazy to see, you know, who in the end kind of makes it and who is just burned out. I coach a lot of kids that are the best players in the country, and they get here and they're done. They're just done. And that's part of my job, is to see who's is and who isn't. You know, they've just put so much focus into tennis, traveled so much, and you know, you feel bad for them. And you know, so that's, you just got to look at what the real good players were doing.
Yeah. I want to switch a little bit here. How have you seen colleges change since you began coaching? Or maybe what's the same? Maybe what are some key things that are same? What's changed? And we're going a ways back, but...
Look, the same is you got a group of kids together, and you got a coach, and that's the most important thing. You know, that a coach sets a culture of a great atmosphere, having a lot of fun, and the kids are together. And period, whether you're winning or losing, that's college tennis. I don't care if it's at USC or, you know, Claremont McKenna, a great Division III school, or wherever. I mean, that is 80% of the experience, being put in a great group and having a great experience, period. Boom. That has not changed at all. But everything else has changed. I mean, it's become a lot bigger. There's a lot more money put in the sports. The facilities are better. It's just amazing, you know, what has happened. If you go around, you know, I mean, people are spending, you know, we're spending almost $12 million on our facility. Well, there's a lot of programs spending $25 million on their tennis facility. I mean, that's a lot of money. So there's a lot more invested in it. But it does come down to, you know, competition and kids. And that hasn't changed.
What about technology? I think one time you mentioned you felt the strings made a huge difference. You know, and there's obviously, you know, articles out on that. That, you know, obviously the rackets have, you know, the game style has changed a little bit. You know, I'm still a big proponent of, you know, players, and this goes back to being an athlete. If you're an athlete, you know, an all-court game is, let's face it, it's highly effective. In fact, you know, Djokovic is more all-court than when he started. Nadal is more all-court than he started. Federer has always been, and he's got a, you know, there's different things each of these guys is trying to continue to work on, and that's a sign of a champion, is somebody's always learning. But anything outside of the facilities, the structure, the infrastructure, that might be you've really seen a change in, maybe tennis-wise.
I mean, you know, strings have changed everything. I mean, the plastic or what we call polyester strings have completely changed the game of tennis. I mean, how you hit the ball, playing more from the baseline, you know, being more solid, having less things to attack, that's changed a lot. And, you know, so there's a lot more baseline tennis happening. So that's a big thing. And I think that's led to a lot of, you know, just being a better athlete, being a more conditioned athlete, because you got to stay out there longer. Matches are a lot more grueling. They're a lot tougher on your body. They're a lot tougher on your arms. We've got a lot more arm injuries. And hence, another reason why we shouldn't be, you know, just focusing on tennis so early. It's tough on the body.
Yeah, a lot of repetition. That's a good point, yeah. Peter, I'm going to ask, kind of segue into some coaching aspects. So what is your philosophy of coaching in general? I think you kind of mentioned it right here, making sure they're having fun, good atmosphere. Anything in general, like let's say maybe even recruiting or that aspect of your coaching philosophy, just maybe give me a couple points that you really feel encapsulate your coaching philosophy.
Well, I think you got to be able to play from every spot on the court. I think you mentioned that earlier, having a complete game. You know, most of the time I don't need to teach these kids a serve or a forehand. I get some of the best kids in the country, but a lot of them don't know how to hit an approach shot or a volley. So we spend a lot of time working on that. So when we're coaching these kids, you know, by the time they're a sophomore, hopefully, they can serve and volley, they can chip and charge, they can do a lot of different things to play differently. In terms of recruiting, I'm recruiting them, they're recruiting me. I pretty much put it out there in the very first phone call that, you know, they're coming to play for my program, to be a part of a team. I think the team atmosphere is incredibly important, and having these kids have a great experience through the team is really important, but they're here to support the team. And, you know, I think that sometimes throws the kids off, because a lot of kids just want to hear, oh, I want to be great, and, you know, I want to become a pro. But, you know, I think, you know, Steve Johnson really helped us with this, that you can come here, be a part of a great team and also have great individual success. So we're not opposed to individual success at all, but we're saying the team can actually prop you up to make you greater as a as an individual and have greater results, and therefore the pressure is a little less.
Good. Along those lines, how would you, for example, on court coaching, you know, different coaches approach it differently. Some are, I remember Steve Denton the first time when I was coaching against him, some of my players came up to me and said, who's that big guy ranting and raving on the court? I mean, Steve's just a lovable guy, but he, you know, he was an imposing presence at 6 foot something, you know, four, and, you know, and some guys are more laid back. So when you're on court coaching your guys, what's your approach?
I certainly want to have a presence on the court, a very big presence on the court. But I also think, you know, playing, coaching in a match is just an extension of practice. So we're working on a ton of things in practice. And then a match is just a little bit more glorified practice in my eyes. You know, we're lucky. We start in September and we end in May. And kind of the things in between don't really matter that much. I mean, you certainly want to win them all, but I'd rather lose a few and learn some lessons and therefore be a better player in May than win them all and not learn anything and not have a good enough game in May. So, you know, myself and the coaches I've coached with, you know, I really encourage them to have a big presence on the court and to, you know, really take part in it and, you know, just converse with the guy. So we're talking a lot out there. And, you know, hopefully it's a conversation and not just direction. You know, hopefully we're right, going back and forth with the kid. And some kids, you know, can be coached more and some kids can be coached less. So, you know, you can only coach a kid as much as they want to be coached. So that can be challenging also.
Yeah, that's interesting because I'm more like yourself. Whereas as a teacher, as a coach and a teacher, to me it's just an extension. You know, when can you actually learn to do something under pressure? Except under pressure, you can manufacture only so much in practice, but during the match is when you get the pressure. So then there's that dialogue that hey, you know, that shot right there, you got to close a little bit. You didn't close, you gave the guy the open court or whatever. Some coaches I've talked to have felt like, well, you know, you pretty much done and said everything. You might as well just let them play. You know, there's that long range in there. Peter, when you guys have guys that have slumps or they're struggling to hold leads, you know, or some people call it choking or whatever, or just a slump in their game, maybe they've going on a losing streak or just not feeling really good about their game, what have you told them? What are some things maybe that and people listening can go, oh, that's a great idea. I should either think that to myself or as a coach, maybe in a coach out there listening could say, yeah, I could use that to help a player.
Well, I think a lot of slumps are about pressure and these kids putting too much pressure on themselves and just feeling that too much. So hopefully as a coach, you know, I'm taking that pressure off them and just trying to get them to develop. You know, I don't think there's an ABC speech that you give somebody, but it's hearing what that person is going through and being able to react what they're going through. So, you know, if it's going to lunch to them, sitting down on the side of the court, sitting down in your office, whatever, it's just having that great relationship where they feel like they can open up to you, you know, and not be judged too harshly. Because I always tell my guys, trust me, you know, I had a lot of issues in my tennis career. Whatever you're feeling, I probably felt. And if by chance I didn't, I certainly coached someone who felt it. So I have a lot of experience and, you know, hopefully I'm giving them an environment where they can just be able to open up and talk freely and not worry about being judged. So, yeah, I do think when kids are not playing as well, they're just pressing. They're usually just trying too hard and trying in the wrong way. So you got to get them to do the right things.
That's good, good advice. That's great stuff. I know recently, just even from a junior perspective or even an adult perspective, there was an adult or, you know, this player or, you know, on both ends. They had moved into a different category. And they go, man, I'm not playing that well. Well, actually, everybody else watching them said, man, you're actually better than you were. It's just that you know, it's a new environment, and so you're losing a few, but that doesn't mean you're a worse player. You're actually better. It's just that the competition's tougher. And so even right. for the less elite player, you know, that can be the case. And I know even, you know, coaching guys in the past, I had one guy, you know, you've had a lot of these, where I had a guy who he'd lost, I think, one match his entire high school career. He was top 20 in the country or something. And he comes to play in college, and then he loses to a guy that he remembers beating, you know. And I go, hey, I call it junioritis. You know, you know, people all of a sudden start growing up and getting bigger and physical, and it's going to happen. Doesn't mean you're a worse player. It means they got better. And that's just, and then what are you going to do about it? You're going to work harder, practice harder, that sort of thing. So, well, but I like the relational thing you said there.
The old adage, I never missed that shot when I was 14. I always made that when I was 16. You know, it's, you know, it's kind of funny how they use the even years. They never say 13 or 15 because they were 14 there at the top in their age group. But, you know, I mean.
I never thought of that. That's a good one. That's a good one.
But, you know, it is funny that, you know, that's always the case. But, you know, you got to be growing as a player and as a person to keep getting better and better. And, you know, what wins in the 14s does not win when you're 18 or 20.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we got a few more minutes because I know you have to run off, and I'll finish up things after that. But, Peter, how would you define success? How would you define success?
I think just playing to your best ability. You know, I think every year you start a year, and some years you're good enough to win a championship, and some years you're not, and certainly we all enjoy winning, but just maximizing your potential. And for me as a coach, if I have a great tennis player but they never did anything in school or never grew as a person, then I've really failed. And hopefully, you know, through tennis we can give them some life lessons, and they can grow in that way. And that's success. Just, you know, like you said earlier, I wasn't that great a junior, but I always tried to learn and always tried to be around people that were successful and learn from them. You know, spent a ton of time with Dick Gould, Dick Leach, Wayne Bryan, all these people that have been successful, and would just, you know, hang out with them and try and bend their ear and talk. And so learned a lot from those people, and, you know, hopefully, you know, I'm a product of all of their advice and just watching them. So, and just also being yourself. You can't be somebody else. You have to be yourself, and, you know, you got to enjoy what you do, the product you're putting out there. So that to me is success, just being happy with what you have, but also doing the most with what you have.
Well, good. Championship characteristics. What are the championship characteristics that you've seen in any level? Let's say college players, pro players, that you've seen. You know, that might be a same characteristic. It might be at a different level, but you know, through each of those time frames.
Competitiveness. Just kids that are stubbornly competitive. I don't like the word just stubborn, because a lot of times stubborn kids don't like to learn, but just that competitiveness, that they're just out there, and it really doesn't matter what the game is. It doesn't matter what the competition is. And they want to compete, and they want to win, and, you know, enjoying that process also. It's not always about winning, but just that really competitiveness that you're bringing it every day, and I'm going to try and do my best just to be as competitive and give myself the best chance of winning.
What advice would you give for parents? Let me move on to something, because I know what your time's fleeting here. What would you say might be missing in junior tennis today, and mainly in the U.S., or anything that needs fixing in U.S. tennis or not? Both sides to it. Just get your thoughts on that.
Having kids play more sports until they're older, and having them go to school. You know, Patrick Rafter just became the head of player development for Tennis Australia You know, one of the very first things he did, he told the kids to go to school. That's a pretty amazing statement. Yeah.
As opposed to
being homeschooled or not going to school as much. You know, he told them to go to high school. You know, so in high school in Australia is much more time-consuming than America. I just think growing that wholeness of that individual is really important. You know, not focusing so much on the ranking and traveling and doing this and going here and going there. You know, it's all really, really exciting when you're 14 and 15, but when you're 18, it gets old pretty quick.
Yeah. What's your view of role in doubles in players' development, and maybe how do you see it moving on in college? And
it's a shame doubles has kind of fallen by the wayside in a lot of ways in juniors. Huge fan of doubles. Play a ton of father-son with my kids. But doubles is great because there isn't as much pressure. You know, you can go out there, win or lose, and not everybody's focusing on that. So that's just a fun way to develop another part of your game that can really help you out later on. And going out there and just playing with your buddy and having a good time is really memorable. You know, not many headlines are written about it, but I think that's where a lot of the enjoyment and the development happens in tennis.
Yeah, I'd agree. There's something about it. You know, I tell people to be a good doubles partner to yourself. You know, a doubles partner would never turn to his double partner and say, man, that was a lame shot. You know, so we shouldn't say it to ourselves in singles either.
That's a great way to look at it. I've actually never heard that said that way. That's really a cool way to look at it.
And I feel like in junior development, one of the things we got to do is get way more doubles in tournaments, because that's exactly what you're saying. There's not a sense of pressure. Okay, you lost, but it's not the pecking order. It's not like, okay, everybody knows you have a partner, and so you don't take it so personally, you know, and you work at it. Right. So I think it's a great way to work on your skills. Hey, I know you got to go. I just wanted to give you a few minutes if there's anything you wanted to say out there or maybe some thoughts you wanted to share.
No, not so much. You know, I think I've kind of gone over and over, you know, creating a whole person and really enjoying the experience of tennis. It can be a great experience, and it can be a tough experience. And, you know, I would just say to all of the parents is let the kids enjoy it. The most successful players I've had, the parents have been out of it. They've let the kids figure it out. You know, Steve Johnson, he never called me. He never called me once about his kid. Not once. You know, all of the kids, you know, I think it's hard for parents to watch kids fall on their face. But I think the most important aspect of tennis and the most important aspect of life is learning how to get up. And I think that's our generation of parents has made a mistake of helping the kids get up too much. I have a kid on my team right now. The parents said, hey, you're on your own. Deal with it. You know, we're not giving you any more money, nothing. And I looked at him and I'm like, wow, those are the greatest parents ever. You know, because
you know, he's not thinking that right now.
No, he's amazing, this kid. He's doing everything on his own.
Good.
And there's a saying, and he's doing a great job, but a lot of the other, we worry too much about our kids. And, you know, I would say I fall into that category too. Very challenging having your own kids on the team. My son's on my team, but you know, to let them fail is okay. Failing in college and failing when they're older, the consequences are extreme. And when they fail in high school, it's okay. They have a chance to come home and get a hug. But it's okay for kids to fail. And I always looked at my kids playing tennis as, what can tennis teach them about life? How can this make them a better person? You know, I certainly want them to win every tennis match they've ever played. But, you know, I've also seen so many kids that were great tennis players not being that successful when they're 25 or 30 or 35. And I think this sport is a gateway, if you use it the correct way, to really a wonderful life and meeting wonderful people and being very successful. And we need to leave our egos out of it, which can be very challenging. I'm certainly not saying that's easy. And let the kid develop. And the best kids, they're just the most competent kids. They can problem solve the best on the court and off the court. And a lot of kids just don't know how to problem solve, and they've had too many things done for them, I would say. So.
Well, Peter, you know, I appreciate your time, appreciate your thoughts, and I wish you obviously a lot of success this year. And I'm sure folks will be chiming in and watching the Trojans. So I really appreciate it, and thanks for calling in.
You got it, Steve.
And folks, I'll be staying on to make a couple comments. And so, Peter, thanks again, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks so much. Thanks. All right.
Okay.
Thanks so
much.
All
righty, bye. So, folks, that was Peter Smith of USC Men's Tennis. And I'd just like to finish up with a few thoughts here. We have we've had some technical difficulties throughout the show. I'm not sure why, but it seems like I was getting a lot of glitches in my headphones. But one of the things I wanted to just finish on was, you know, we talked about actually towards the end when I said that being a good doubles partner to yourself. For me, I have a philosophy that years ago that I started with my two of my captains. We were back at the All-American tournament, which was held at Texas at the time, and I wanted them to have some buy-in and some sharing on what we would call focus our team on the rest of that year. Well, it turned out to be, I have an acronym that I use, and it's called FOCUS, but it's not, it's unique. It's different than some of the other ways it's used. It stands for four different aspects, and that's fundamentals, opportunity, conditioning, unity, and success. And the fundamentals starts off with, we have to be fundamentally solid all-court games that pressure opponents. And I'll get into this some other time, but that's the beginning there. The opportunities is daily realized in practice and in a challenging schedule. In other words, you have to have the ability, you can have the skill set, but you have to have the opportunity to prove it and get out there and compete hard. A third thing is conditioning. It has to be unrivaled by our opponents. And Peter and I were talking about this today, is that the way the game is, you have to be so fit when you step on that court and shake hands with your opponent that you can stare them in the eyes and they say, buddy, no matter how long this match goes, I'm on top. I'm stronger than you. I'm fitter than you. And that creates a huge mental advantage for yourself. Unity as a team that will propel your team beyond individual abilities. And Peter alluded to this, actually. It's the idea that team is bigger than individual. But if you have team unity, that will help create things that you otherwise wouldn't have gotten as an individual. And then the last thing is success. Well, if you do all these things, you're going to have success. There's just no way around it. So if you have good fundamentals, great opportunities, and opportunities are every day. If you see every day as an opportunity, that's fundamental, one of the fundamentals, actually. And then creating a tough schedule where you can compete and show grit even in the face of loss. And then you have to be fit, well-conditioned, and have team unity and success. And that's the great thing about college tennis is you have this unity, this team unity factor in there that can it's different than just being an individual player. But one of the things I'd mentioned about being a good doubles player to yourself and as a singles player. So whether you're doubles, you know, the easy thing about that is you have somebody to talk through in a match. If you have good chemistry, it's really easy. If you have bad chemistry, it's not so easy. But so one of the things, Jim Lehrer, many, many years ago, this is probably 30 years ago, I jumped out on court with him, and it was very well developed, his system of what champions do between points. And this has been logged. He did did a lot of research and watching great champions, and for the most part, 99.9% do this. And it's on our practice shirts, and it's PR. I've done this for many years. And there's a positive physical response, a relaxation, preparation, and ritual. And I'll just go over this for those of you out there that between the points, If you think about it, most people are always taking lessons to get a shot better, etc. Well, really, you play more time. More time is spent between the points than there is actually playing the point. Even on the tour, I think the average shot time is 10 seconds, you know, that you're engaged in a rally. And then there's 20, you know, in the juniors or a lot of USGA, there's 20 seconds between points. Well, that's a lot of time. Well, what do you do with it? Some people just rush. They just go lose the point, win the point, go up and serve. And that's not what champions do. Champions generally take about 15 seconds between points. Well, what are they doing with that time? Well, what you'll notice is there's generally a positive physical response, whether the point's won or lost. They control the emotions. They know how to adjust the adrenaline when they need it. That's why Federer, for example, is not so emotional all the time. But boy, when he needs it, he lets out a yelp and a fist pump. But there's a positive physical response. And normally I do clinics or I work with players on this, but I can explain it over the radio. For example, your racket needs to go in your opposite hand with the head up, not down, not like mopey, but more like you put in a gun in a holster, the kind of an authoritative look with the tip up. Just don't hang onto the racket all the time with it drooping. The shoulders are back. The head's up. Don't droop the shoulders or the head or the bill of your hat. So it's a positive physical response. If somebody saw you respond, they'd say, hey, is that person winning? They wouldn't know. Or losing. They wouldn't know. You can say nice shot or whatever. But any correction you give yourself happens at this time. The positive physical response, you say, man, next time I got to hit more top, or that was a good shot. You know, and slap yourself on the thigh and say, yeah, that's it. Let's go. That sort of thing. That happens all right then. That is a split-second reaction. After that, you need to relax. The heart rate needs to drop. So we calmly walk back to the baseline if you happen to be up at net. A lot of people don't venture that way these days, but we want to be up at net. Let's say we turn around, put the racket in the opposite hand, and we walk calmly back to the baseline. The heart drops, and you can walk. That's why you see players focusing on their strings. They go back and get a towel. So they're just managing their emotional state, not too much elation, not too much, you know, anxiety. And so they're going through that relaxation period. Now, if the flip side is, let's say a positive physical response and you tend to be low energy, well, then you should use that time. You're going to relax, but the next stage is when you're going to try and up your energy level. And some players, you'll see, they'll just run on the court or kind of start moving their feet because they got to get their energy level up because they recognize after the point it's too low. So there's a positive physical response, relaxation stage, and then there's preparation. And this preparation is get yourself amped up if you need it, calm down if you need to, take a little extra time. That's part of your relaxation. But this is where you decide your serve placement, your shot pattern. You know, are you staying on task with your strategy? Momentum management issues, what is their weakness? This is where you're thinking. And you can do that during your relaxation as well. But remember, we're only talking about 15 seconds total. So you have your, you know, where you're going to go in terms of my first shot. I'm going to kick the guy out wide. It's going to open up the court. I'm going to hit my forehand cross court. You know, so for example, if I was on the ad side, I kick it out wide. He hits it up the middle, and then I hit my forehand cross court to the deuce side. I mean, that's your plan A. I mean, that's just, you know, ahead of time, hey, that's his weak side. I'm going to try and go there, and if the court's open, I'm hitting it. So, but that's where your preparation is. You should have a plan already. And then the last thing is ritual. By then, you are brain dead. You get up to the service court. You go through a ritual, and I work with rituals on players routinely. Everybody should have a ritual. There's not a basketball player on the planet. There is not a, on the pro level, or college, there's not a diver, for sure. There's not a golfer. You'd be hard-pressed to find somebody who's a champion in a sport who doesn't have a ritual when they set up. So, and there always has to be a pause. You'll see this in basketball. Take a bounce, set, and then shoot. There's a pause. Golf, you address the ball, you pause, take your backswing. And then there's a rhythm based around that. Same thing with tennis. A lot of tennis players make the fundamental error. They have maybe good technique, but they go up to dribble the ball and start serving, as opposed to dribble the ball. They should have already called the score, first of all. That's my pet peeve. Call the score, then do your ritual. So it's you do your ritual, pause, then you start your swing. Because technically, the point doesn't start till you start your swing. So if you're rushing through it, you know, that's sometimes that's just you need to give yourself a break, just mentally, just to relax and settle in. So for better precision. So positive physical response, relaxation, preparation, and ritual. The reason I brought this up again is we talked about being a good doubles, or I mentioned about being a good doubles player to yourself. And one of the fundamental things you need to do is have good PR between the points. So what are some common things people do? They'll serve the ball, they'll hang the racket, or they'll be returning, and let's say they lose a point, they'll hang the racket, slump the shoulders, and they'll go straight to the baseline. And just notice this with people. They'll go straight to the baseline, turn around, and serve. There's been no preparation, and there's been no relaxation or ritual. And so they get caught up in the match, and this is why they lose momentum, because they have poor momentum management skills in this area. It's particularly if you've lost 2 points in a row. One show I'll go over momentum management skills. But you definitely do not want to let somebody win 3 points in a row. Conversely, you want to try and win 3 points in a row. Obviously, you want to win every point, but most people don't think that way. They think, hey, I broke, so they let up, and then they lose the first point of the next game. That's poor momentum management. So this PR helps you think through those things to say, look, I'm going to control this momentum. I really need this point. I'm going to step back. Know exactly what I'm going to do, be relaxed about it, and when I step and do my ritual, all pistons are firing and I'm ready to go. So that is how you, in one way, you can be a good doubles partner to yourself, because in doubles, it's the same thing. You want to have a ritual where you go together, you walk together. This is also chronicled or noticed in a really good championship double. Look at the Bryan brothers. Simon Asplund had really good doubles. I mean, you just have these examples where people, I call it, most people play doubles like they're passing ships in a night. Somebody serves, and they stay on the baseline walking back and forth, and the person at net walks back and forth. No, what you should do as a serving team is always come together in the middle, or the net person walks back to the baseline, have a little chat and a walk about, as they say in Australia, with the server, and then jogs back to the net with a nice little energetic hop step off the discussion and you go back to net. That would be an example of good PR for doubles. So we'll talk about that more in length some other time. But I had a really good talk with Peter Smith. I apologize for any technical difficulties. It sounded like from my end a couple times it was choppy, and or I might have lost connection or something, but we got back. So until next time, if you have any questions, you can email me at steve@coachsteveclarkphd.com. And you can leave some questions there. In a couple weeks, I'll be having Alan Fox. So if you have any questions for him, our show I had here with him a few weeks ago had some technical difficulties, and we ended up cutting it short, but we will start off where we left. So thanks again. And I will be talking to you shortly. And like I say all the time, let her rip. And one of the things I want to leave you with is your normal inspiring? Thanks again, and talk to you soon.